Gloria al bravo pueblo que el yugo lanzó. ¡Vamos!
Oh, listen back to the bad old good old days of Hugo Chavez, when the leader of Venezuela could get the world's attention at the drop of a hat, or in this case, a speech at the United Nations, where he speaks most undiplomatically about the President of the United States.
Yesterday, ladies and gentlemen, from this rostrum, the President of the United States, the gentleman to whom I refer as the devil, came here.
In 2006, when the prosperous oil-fueled communist populism of Venezuela's Chavez was the envy of less economically stable countries in the Western Hemisphere, Venezuela's colorful, confrontational leader got lots of attention back then. But after he died in 2013, the power and stability he seemed to leave behind looked intact for a while. You're listening to the enthusiasm there as Nicolas Maduro succeeded Chavez and was elected by a margin of less than 1% in April of 2013, just as oil prices, the magic and the glue of Venezuelan prosperity, dropped precipitously, revealing a political reality Maduro would have to face without the godlike charisma of Hugo Chavez.
It's a country that has gone through its longest and highest oil boom in its history, and ended up that period over-indebted with a destroyed productive capacity, and now it cannot face the reduction in the price of oil.
It's Ricardo Hausmann predicting on this program the food shortages and economic instability to come. Former AP correspondent in Caracas, Hannah Dreyer, watched in June 2016 as Venezuela crumbled. Her reports on this program riveting, even though Venezuela had lost the media's attention compared to the old Chavez days.
Feels like just in the past couple months, things have gotten so much worse here. There's been a slow decline for years, but now we're seeing food riots daily. There aren't cars on the streets anymore because there are no car parts and nobody's working anyway. It just feels like a totally different country and one where absolutely nothing is working.
It was June of 2016. Maduro used his power to confront the very people Chavez once cultivated as his base, a base now as dissatisfied with Venezuela's leadership as the capitalists and the technocrats. Here's Carolina Acosta Alzuro, a journalism professor at the University of Georgia and a native of Venezuela, speaking in April of this year.
The government of Nicolas Maduro has become increasingly authoritarian. I think it's a government that's determined not to hold elections ever again. And that has to worry anyone. It's completely anti-democratic.
As recently as just a couple of days ago, 13 countries from around the region all called on the government of Maduro to cancel the Constituent Assembly, as I think all of them see this as a stratagem to avoid having to contend with the clear disappointment of the Venezuelan people with how the Chavistas, or as they're sometimes called, Bolivarians, have mismanaged the country and its economy.
That's Patrick Duddy, who served as U.S. ambassador to Venezuela in the Chavez years, speaking on The Takeaway late last month, relating how the stage was being set for what happened this weekend.
We declare ourselves in legitimate rebellion, united today more than ever with the brave people of Venezuela, to disown the murderous tyranny of Nicolas Maduro.
The words of a group of armed Venezuelans dressed in military fatigues in a video circulated this past Sunday. The same day, a group of armed men stormed one of the country's biggest arsenals of weapons, leaving two dead. Covering the latest in Venezuela's astounding fall into chaos is Ana Vanessa Herrero, New York Times reporter in Caracas. Ana, welcome to the program, and what's the latest?
Hi, John. Well, during the last few weeks, democracy in Venezuela has been an issue in most conversations inside and outside the country. After a very questioned election to pick the new Constituent Assembly that will write the new constitution, many wonder what's going to happen. So on Saturday, the Constituent Assembly ousted the Attorney General, one that has been very critic around Maduro's government, and put her in her place, a new member that's really close to the party. So that same day, we were announced that this will continue for a maximum of 2 years. But beyond that, after the assembly took place, the world learned that the real point of this new superbody is not to write the new constitution, but to gain power over all that was lost in votes. So Maduro has very little popularity right now with the people, and they know they can't win an election. So this is the only way they can control decisions around political leaders, which they already said will put to jail. And of course, this is how they will decide over the economy. Now, both the Vatican and the UN have spoken about the situation, the latest being the UN denouncing the generalized and systematic use of force in Venezuela. Now, actually, this Monday, we learned that another mayor was sentenced to prison for allowing protest in one of the municipalities of Caracas. With him, we have now five mayors either sentenced to prison or chased by the government.
And the Trump administration has sanctioned in response to some of these actions. Would you say that the convening of the Constituent Assembly is essentially the beginning of a Soviet-style secretariat to run the country? Nothing democratic about it at all?
Nothing democratic about it at all. I mean, the Constituent Assembly, it's in the Constitution. It's a power that the Constitution allows the people to decide. The problem is that this was not decided by the people. This was decided by only the president and the ones close to him. But there's a discontent that's showing in very new ways. This Sunday, an uprising was controlled by the armed forces in Venezuela. But before this was not before. A small group of retired militaries and other actives took 90 combat rifles. So this is the same situation we had a few months ago when a pilot named Oscar Perez took a police helicopter and attacked the Supreme Court. So Mr. Perez talked to a Venezuelan journalist and said, "This is now how they will fight. They are gathering and training more people." And this is something many think can become some kind of guerrilla situation in the future.
Ana Vanessa Herrero, New York Times reporter in Caracas. Thanks so much, Ana.
Thank you.
With the media's erratic attention to what could end up being the biggest humanitarian crisis in this hemisphere in a century, Alejandro Velasco, professor at NYU and author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela, joins us now. Alejandro, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Even though there is not a media focus on the kinds of things that are going on in Venezuela that Ana has described, should we conclude that the U.S. is not involved behind the scenes in the way that they were in El Salvador and in Central America during the 1980s?
No, I mean, certainly the United States has a strong presence. They have the interest of oil, which remains Venezuela's primary export. I think the issue is that because Venezuela has been so unstable for such a long time now, it's easy to confuse the sort of endogenous domestic reasons for that instability and in parts of the discourse of the Venezuelan government, the ways in which intervention, foreign intervention, whether nefarious or explicit, is actually contributing to that. It's certain that the United States has a role, and it's doing so in ways both explicit and covert. In terms of what is explicit, it's targeting, either through sanctions or through legal channels, interests and people of the government, both in the United States and in Venezuela, and it's jailing those people here in the United States. But also, you see significant amounts of support for the opposition, either through funneling funds or also through lending rhetorical cover for the actions that the opposition is taking as the government turns increasingly authoritarian.
I guess what is confusing to me is what the end game would be here. I mean, there's the possibility of a failed nation in Venezuela, which would be unprecedented in this hemisphere in the last century. But there's also the scenario of, you know, I mentioned El Salvador a moment ago, you know, a kind of a persistent right-wing death squads or left-wing death squads roaming the streets and a kind of disorder that's divided in political terms between the left and the right and the U.S. taking sides. Is that what we're seeing possibly in the future?
certainly the opposition right now is at a crossroads, at a significant crossroads. And the report that we just heard pointed to that to some extent, which is that as the government closes avenues for democratic engagement, for people to express their discontent at the ballot box or in other democratic institutions, then the opportunities for resisting that government become more and more tied to armed resistance or other forms of insurrection. The problem with that, of course, is that the opposition has gained a tremendous amount, especially in the international arena, by cementing its credentials as a democratic opposition, especially over the last 3, 4, 5 years. This is much different from the beginning era of the Chavez years when it openly engaged in insurrectionary tactics, including coups and oil industry strikes. But the issue now is that to follow along that path not only would prove extremely detrimental internationally for its legitimacy, but it would also prove significantly detrimental domestically. Polls, for instance, show that the vast majority of the population oppose, especially the population that is disenchanted with the government but not yet aligned with the opposition, popular sectors, people in barrios, are opposed to more confrontational tactics that further disrupt their daily lives. And so this really puts the opposition in a bind. Do we proceed in a more aggressive way? Do we embrace these sectors that are calling for armed insurrection? Or do we try to proceed along a more democratic path, even though that path is increasingly becoming more narrow?
Does it strike you as unusual that the U.S., that could be possibly a mediator here in Venezuela, is not really taking that role?
The fact is that the United States cannot play a role for a couple of reasons. Number one, historically speaking, as we heard also at the top of the hour, Chavez and Chavismo made a tremendous point about their anti-imperialist credentials. And here, of course, empire in the hemisphere is the United States. So that every time the United States speaks, it actually benefits the government because it plays exactly into that line of argument that it is the United States that is behind the instability in the country, even though, again, most of that instability is actually owed to poor policies on the part of the government. And in the Obama administration, the policy was to try to play a sort of lead from behind, right, to let other countries in the region take center stage in condemning the government of Venezuela and its anti-democratic practices and calling attention. The problem is that Latin America's politics have shifted significantly. Whereas, of course, 3, 4, 5 years ago, we had an ascendant left. We had the pink tide, so-called. Now, many countries in Latin America have shifted right, have conservative governments, some of them with also questionable credentials, like in Brazil with Michel Temer.
Sure.
And so as you see more of the hemisphere taking a stronger line against Venezuela, it does so from a position of a right-left conflict that is very familiar to Latin Americans and to people in Venezuela, so that the government can also use this to its advantage to say, well, of course Brazil, well, of course Argentina, well, of course Mexico and Peru and all these other countries who are now so completely aligned with the United States are going to attack us. And this is why we must continue to fight.
Alejandro Velasco is professor at NYU and author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Thank you so much.
Thank you.